Okay, we'll get going again. Our next talk is Kevin Doyle on the Irish Committee. Just a speak for about 20 minutes, and we'll open up for questions and answers.
Thanks, Alan. Well, first of all, let me say that I have a slightly different job here, and I wonder should I have really gone first, but I'm to talk a little bit about the history of May Day, and that's probably where I'm going to confine myself here. But as you all well know, history talks can be a little bit dry, and I can be a bit dry when I'm speaking about them as well. So in this game, I've asked for the help here of Carol, because I want to bring us back momentarily to a situation that was... However, we wipe the smile off his face now, because I want to bring him back to one of the key events that's at the centre of the origins of May Day, and this was what happened to a number of people who were accused of actions which I'll explain about in greater detail later. But just for a moment, consider here that if it was today, and you all know, a good number of people here would know Carol. If tomorrow, or say during the protest last December here in Cork, which was a good protest against the cuts, I think many of you were there. Just say, for example, transpose yourself into the idea that at that protest, someone threw a bomb into the police who were there around the protest on that day. We don't know who it was, but someone did it. It was happened. Now, obviously, this is quite a different climate of political atmosphere to what we live in at the moment. But I'm just asking for the moment to think of that. Now, say shortly after that, you heard that Carol was the person who did it. Right? Now, many of you would know Carol, and you'd say... I don't think so, right? Anyway, it turns out Carol wasn't actually there. He was there the time the bomb was thrown. He was actually down the road. He got off to get his photographs shot off up to Indian media. So he wasn't actually there. But we've now heard the following day that Carol has actually been arrested and he's been charged with the murder of two Gardaí there on Patrick's Bridge, right? So you think to yourself, well, this can't possibly come to anything more than this, because there's no way he would have done it in the first place. Whoever did it, but there's no way he would have done it, and in the second place, he wasn't even there. Now, say a trial goes forward, and you hear that it's going to go to a stage where it's possible that Carol will be charged, and he is charged. And at the trial, unbelievably, he's actually found guilty of these charges. So no, you absolutely are certain there's no way he was there on the day involved in that crime. But no, he's been convicted of them. And on foot of this, he's been sentenced to death, right? So you can imagine your outrage as the person who knows him. Just think for a minute, the person you know, that if this was the situation facing him in a few days' time, that he was possibly going to be executed by hanging at the time of the Haymarket Martyrs, and that was the prospect for him. A long and involved campaign begins to try and win a reprieve for Carol. All the evidence, as it's examined in greater and greater detail, points to the fact that it absolutely couldn't have been Carol who did it, but he's still to be executed. And so the time arrives when he is taken to the gallows. And Carol, our dear comrade and friend, who we've known for many years, is executed, and he dies. And that's really one of the key stories, I think, at the heart of the Haymarket Martyrs case, which was the really key event in the origins of May Day. So thanks, Carol, for that, for acting as the comrade we all know and love. But I kind of just... I just kind of wanted to use that to bring it home to people. To bring it home to people that at the heart of this story of the origins of May Day is a really tragic event that actually really struck a chord with political activists of all hues and with workers across the world and with workers' organisations over a long period of time. And it linked in with other issues and came to be ordained as one of the key events behind the origins of May Day. But it's really a terrible tragedy. And really it begins at the fact that at the time of the United States, in 1884, what was a precursor to the American Federation of Labour ordained that there would be a rolling campaign to bring about the 8-hour day. And they basically set this in motion in 1884, but by 1886 they had set that would be the deadline by which it would be achieved. And so around May Day of 1886, they particularly organized a series of large protests across the United States. New York, Detroit had very, very large protests. And Chicago, which was then one of the main strongholds of the workers' movement in the United States, in part because it had large numbers of immigrant workers from Germany, Italy, Ireland, who were working in some of their larger concerns, manufacturing concerns. Chicago was a big hub, I understand, in terms of the development of American industry. And so it was a place where there was a lot of work, there was a huge number of immigrants, working conditions were extremely harsh. And in Chicago there was a massive protest and marched on Michigan Avenue on the 1st of May 1886, a massive show of strength that called for the 8-hour day to be instituted as the recognized working time across the country. And of course this was a demand that was also being fought for in other countries around the world, and it was being looked to as a possible great achievement if it could be brought about. There was a particular strike going on in Chicago at the time, which was going on at the McCormick Harvesting Machine Company. And in fact it was largely made up of Irish American workers. And there had been a strike ongoing there since February, and the strike had been very bitter. The strikers had been beaten up on a number of occasions. They had been attacked by these Pinkerton paramilitary hands, which Pinkerton's being a particular force, private police force that companies could hire in the United States. And workers on strike at McCormick Harvesting had been attacked on a number of occasions. About half the workers were out in strike, and about half were continuing to go in and were regarded as scabs. But the scabs were under such pressure that they had to be regularly protected when they were either coming or going from the plant. And shortly after May 1st, on May 3rd, 1886, a large protest took place to offer solidarity with the workers at McCormick Harvesting, because it was seen as the key dispute, and its victory in the city was seen as important for the overall campaign to achieve the 8-hour day. During the protest outside McCormick Harvesting, some of the scabs attempted to leave and were rushed by a large number of workers. There was an ensuing melee, and the police moved in and opened fire on the workers and killed, I think, two workers. This led to an absolutely outrageous mood in the city of Chicago, and immediately socialists and anarchists called for a protest the following day on May 4th in Chicago, in Haymarket Square. And they said that the initial leaflets called for workers to turn out in great force, but shortly after that the leaflets were torn down, and it was asked that workers turn up there in large numbers to show solidarity. And August Spees, one of the organisers and one of the militants who was later charged in the Haymarket case, said when he addressed the huge crowd that turned up to show their solidarity with those who had been killed, he said, "There seems to prevail the opinion in some quarters that this meeting which we have organised today in Haymarket has been called for the purpose of inaugurating a riot. Hence these warlike preparations on the part of so-called law and order forces. However, let me tell you at the beginning that this meeting has not been called for such purposes today. The object of this meeting is to explain the general situation of the 8R movement and to throw light upon various incidents in connection with it. And of course what he was referring to was the connection between the struggle at McCormick Harvesting Machine and the struggle for the 8-hour day. It was the struggle of working people in the city to attempt to win better conditions and better wages for themselves. A short while after the meeting got underway, the police moved in to actually stop any further speeches from the platform, and they marched into the large crowd in formation. It appears at this time that a bomb was thrown into the ranks. It's never been identified who threw the bomb, and it's never been cleared up at all as to who exactly was behind it. But what actually happened then was that the police panicked, opened fire. It seems that about 4 police were killed from the bomb, but the remaining casualties were all due to police fire, which basically was scattergun and throughout the crowd. In all, 8 police and 4 civilians were killed. It caused absolute uproar in Chicago. There was a general assault on the community of the left and the workers' movement in the city. Large numbers of people were arrested, and the whole protest against the 8-hour day was thrown into jeopardy under the force of police repression. And 8 people connected directly or indirectly with the rally only were arrested and afterwards charged with the murder of one of the policemen. These were August Spees, Albert Parsons, Adolf Fisher, George Engel, Louis Ling, Michael Schwab, Samuel Felden, and Oscar Neeb. 5 of these spies, Fisher, Engel, Link, and Schwab, were German immigrants, and a 6th, Neeb, was a US citizen of German descent. The other men, Parsons and Fielmo, were born in the United States and England, respectively. The trial of the Haymarket Martyrs was marked by an admission by the prosecution that they had no direct evidence linking any of the charged persons with the actual bomb, either with its construction or with the act of throwing it, or in any way having anything to do with it. The jury itself, if I can find a quote, the eventual composition of the jury was farcical, being made up of businessmen, their clerks, and a relative of one of the dead policemen. No proof was offered by the state that any of the 8 men before the court had thrown the bomb, had been connected with destroying, or had even approved of such act. In fact, only 3 of the 8 had been in Haymarket Square that evening. So you can see where the case of Carroll comes back into the light. It quickly became very clear that what was on trial, at the actual trial of these comrades, was the ideas that they stood for. In a number of articles, the New York Times described the incident at Haymarket as the bloody fruit of the villainous teachings of the anarchists. And the Chicago Times described the defendants as arch counselors of riot, pillage, incendiarism, and murder. Other reporters described them as bloody brutes, red ruffians, dynamite anarchists, bloody monsters, cowards, cutthroats, thieves, assassins, and fiends. They didn't get a fair trial. In fact, the trial completely focused in on their ideas, on their activities, on their role and on their prominence within the 8-hour movement and within the socialist and anarchist movements in the city. They were, of course, found guilty. 7 were sentenced to death and 1, Neeb, was given a 15-year sentence. It's really at this point, this was in November On appeal, Fielding and Schwab's sentences were reduced to life. All the remaining sentences were upheld. So five sentences were upheld as sentences of death by hanging. A huge campaign got underway, and this is in some ways where the campaign for the 8-hour day, campaign to save the Haymarket Martyrs, and the international position of this day as a day which we link with the workers' movement and with the celebration of the struggles of the workers' movement all dovetail. Campaign went on for the best part of the year, but was unsuccessful despite the fact that it did raise great awareness of the issues at stake, the issue of the 8-hour day, and various other issues to do with the conditions of workers in the United States and elsewhere. On the night of November 10, 1887, Louis Ling, who was one of the condemned men, managed to kill himself by blowing his head off with a gun cap. And on the next day, November 7th, Spees, Parsons, Fisher, and Ingalls were taken to the gallows in white robes and hoods. And Spees cried out very famously, "The time will come when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you strangle here today." May Day became identified in the aftermath of this as International Workers' Day in memory of the Haymarket Martyrs for two kind of clear reasons. One was the fact that the Haymarket struggle and the deaths of the Haymarket Martyrs was inextricably linked to the struggle for better practical working conditions. The 8-hour day was a central demand, which was eventually achieved, as we know. But it also became important because the unjust death of the Haymarket Martyrs, the fact that it was very clear almost immediately that these men were innocent of this crime, but at the same time they were going to be murdered, they were going to be executed, they were going to be taught a lesson, because it was important to teach the workers' movement a lesson. That sense of injustice and the travesty that the Haymarket Martyrs case exemplifies meant that the day also became very important as a traditional day in which people have identified very importantly the need to fight injustices everywhere, and that the workers' movement is inextricably linked to the fight for a just society. So the Haymarket Martyrs today are buried in Waldheim Cemetery in Chicago. They were all later cleared of the charges and pardoned. A lot of fucking good on us, Jenny, of course. Dead as
no point in both of the road and the hospital.
No. And Spees, I will leave you with this final address from August Spees, who said, when Spees addressed the court after he had been sentenced to die, he was confident that this conspiracy against the Haymarket Martyrs and against the 8-hour day movement would not succeed. And he said, "If you think that by hanging us you can stamp out the labour movement, the movement from which the downtrodden millions and the millions who toil in misery and want expect salvation, if this is your opinion, then hang us. Here you will tread on a spark, and there behind you and in front of you and everywhere flames will blaze up. It is a subterranean fire. You cannot put it out." And I think that very much is the case, as we all know, still today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Thomas.
Sorry, was there anything, where, after that then, where did Larson Economy come in then?
Good but question.
I know, but have you any history on it?
Specifically linked to the Haymarket Martyrs?
Yeah, because Connolly started up then, remember in 1913, I think Connolly came in.
But I think they were all inspired by Benson, and Connolly was worked in the United States for a long time and was involved in the...
He worked in Singapore,
that's right, and he was involved in the union activity there, and was very inspired by the methods and by what he learned there to do with the fight for workers' rights. I mean, and I think he...
But then he left... He saw when all the whole thing was such a big kind of a bourgeoisie that he decided to leave from it. He left it in after that. He did. It was a growing documentary on TV about that. And where did Larson come in then?
Try to stick to Meta.
Oh, sorry, apologize.
Any other questions, Thomas?
I have heard that story before. not the Haymarket story and the May Day 1886 and the 8-hour day. But it seems like the feeling I always get from it, looking back, is that here was a movement of hundreds of thousands of people, well, across the world, but definitely across North America and in Chicago. Like on May Day 1886, you fill that massive street, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and very powerful, and closing in on their target, and winning strikes, and maybe they're going to win that McCormack strike that you were talking about. So, then you have this explosion, and you have all the raids. They break down all the left-wing press and organizations. To pick up local people. They arrest all the key leaders, tank some of them, and basically divert everything away from the action on the streets. And then, all right, 10 years later, they're all acquitted. Some of them are dead. And I cannot get the feeling from that whole story that, like, the state played a card of repression and framing people, and that they actually did take all the things. And that bomb, for example, and the dead policeman, they basically killed the 8-hour day movement as it was at that time. And it may have been a fact for generations later, but
yeah.
It's an example of like the state and the employer. They played a stronger card than the workers at the time.
Yeah.
The workers were playing mass participation, direct action, like, and protest. Like, for me, it's always a very, really sad story, not really heartwarming or maybe they came from this.
I actually think you're very right, and I mean, you know what was interesting recently was the struggle in Wisconsin. Well, I think probably a lot of people would know of that here, but there was that spoof phone call done, and it was just an example that the governor, I think it would be, of Wisconsin, was actively, you know, it was suggested to him that would it be a good idea to cause trouble at one of the big protests with the idea of sowing division and concern and, of course, adverse publicity. And, I mean, that was a small example of the sort of thing that happened in Mayday. But I do think they're well used of this idea of using violence and orchestrating violence in our ranks because it does create a lot of trouble, and also the repression that follows is huge. So perhaps you're right in that it was more inspirational later. I mean, I think I agree with you also. It's a very tragic story, I think. The particular deaths of the people involved, even though it raised great awareness at the time, was dreadful. You know what I mean? To be executed like that, it's fine to look back, but their families were... you know, absolutely gutted by what happened. And for many people, of course, they can go on from that, but many others would have walked away and said, you know, that's not worth it. I can't do that. And I think it does show the absolute violence of the state and what it's willing to do. I mean, it's never been proved who threw the bomb, which is an interesting thing, but I mean, you know, that's just there. I mean, it's. I'm sure there's been plenty of efforts put into finding someone who might have been sympathetic to the workers' cause, who might have thrown the bomb. I'd say there was plenty of effort put into that, but no one has ever been brought. So it's quite likely it was an act of an agent provocateur and had the desired effects that you're talking about.
I think there's always
the end of
my
own
day. I say there wasn't an action provocateur, but I think there's a danger going down that line in the sense that that's almost saying that within the ranks of our movement there aren't people okay for doing that kind of stuff, not wrong-headed event with it. And because what follows from it that argument puts them in our ranks. And it only takes one or two people with the capability who feel that they're capable of this. The bomb is going to make the difference or whatever to keep things off to do it. And so you're always in that argument or ideas and those tactics. Anyway, the other thing is though, see, it's a lot of user pressure, and I think that it's inevitable when your movement becomes big and strong and threatens the status quo that the forces that they apply against you, they use more violence than they use more repression. I think that it's kind of not the natural order of things within conflict. And I don't think there's any way of having of guarding against it apart from building your movement as strong and as democratic and as resilient as the best idea that you can. And I think that's all you can do. And there's no way you can prevent that. I mean, exposing it when it does happen is good, but sometimes I think there's a danger in getting too far into the second idea that, you know, if we just stop that bomb happening, or if we manage to expose the nature of the way the bosses do manipulate things and stuff, that we'd actually be able to counter it any other way other than building a mass movement. Because they'll always do it when the opportunity arises. They will always revert to that. They will revert to fascism, they will revert to the oppression of their imprisonment. So, I have mixed feelings about things, but the way I always look at things like this is that, like you said, later, the inspiration from it probably in succeeding generations came along, but everybody participated in that movement, everybody participated in the amnesty movement, the afterwards for the lads and stuff like that. Everyone who fought that picked up some level of ideas and inspiration, obviously. And everyone probably transmitted that at some level onwards to people afterwards. And it probably gave birth to one of many different trade union activists or left-wing activists in generations to follow. And I think that's, we've always to look at our work in that sense, that you can't tell, you know, when you throw that pebble into the water or the ripples are going to come out, you know, in both senses. So you've got to think obviously in the immediate, but also be thinking the big picture, the long term as well. Sometimes you're only little parts of something much larger over time. And obviously these people are committed anarchists, they believe in a revolutionary transformation of society. The fact that we're still talking about them now and they're still talking about their ideas, I mean, it's a testament to the value of it, you know.
You know, please.
I agree with James in that, like that we shouldn't become paranoid about the infiltration by but it has happened. It has happened in Ireland. It happened that the official IRA were infiltrated by Little John brothers in the early 70s with the intention of starting politically motivated, well, it would appear to be politically motivated bank robbery, which led in time to, once this thing got rolling, that a lot of security being shot dead and some political opinion against the organization, as well as and there was also a case of a man that interfered in the provisional IRA, and he was pushing people to steal a harp from the National Museum, which actually he did himself, and he was caught. And eventually, that particular man actually was actually suspected, and he was taken to be executed, but he managed to escape. And but it just shows things do happen. And another thing I think about is that it either was a provocateur or it was a wildcat action, you know, by an undisciplined person. And I think that's a very important point, because one thing I've seen happen is that small groups that support a big movement, they often come out with a rhetoric, and the rhetoric scares people off. I'll give an example now. The HBR marches. My wife and myself and our two small children used to go to HBR marches, right? I used to take a 3-year-old child by the hand, and my wife was carrying her baby in arms, you know. And there were these leaflets given out by a group that was supporting it. And they were saying, we're angry, we're fed up with this, we're going to cause trouble. Basically, like they were saying, we're going to cause trouble at the next meeting, right? Next meeting, I didn't want my children to be injured in a riot, right? So I went up myself, my wife and two children. with running hack. But is this sort of, you know, people just talking rhetoric, sort of loud mouthed, sort of poisonous rhetoric with nothing behind it, does damage? I just want to ask you one question. Like, the anti-authoritarian socialist movement, commonly called anarchism, was very powerful at that particular time. But it, you know, it hasn't that power today that it had then. You know, in your opinion, what is the reason for that? Would you say?
Well, the short answer is that I mean, it did go. That was a very high point, particularly in the United States, and of course, the anarchist movement was very strong in Latin America and in parts of continental Europe at that time, and it did suffer a decline afterwards. But of course, it's regained a lot of its influence now again. I mean, why was it particularly strong then? I think is because it was strongly involved in the struggles of ordinary people. I think particularly if you look at the anarchist movement in Chicago at the time, it was a really vibrant, large movement. Of course, it had come across with the immigrants, but it also was very relevant to people's lives because the conditions of working life in the state, as many immigrants found out to the cost, were extremely harsh. It was a violent, authoritarian mentality in a lot of factories, manufacturing situations in the state. I mean, the idea that it was the land of milk and honey was quickly disabused from people. And of course, anarchists had the presence on the shop floor, and also they had the ideas to say, well, you know, this is nothing other than absolute greed by employers. Mm. There is no need for people to be treated like it. They had the ideas, the presence, and the willingness, the commitment to fight for these things. And I think those were the things that made it strong in the past and are the basis for making it strong again. You know, that commitment, application to where people are fighting now, and also ideas about why it can be different.
Jim, can I ask one short question? I'm intrigued to speak and thought you were brilliant. But the question, two short questions I was asked. Why was it called the hay market? Was the hay being made or what? Sorry, I wasn't.
I'd imagine it was the hay market at one stage. It was Hay Market Square in Chicago.
And why was it called hay? Was it originally for the hay?
A problem, presumably.
You mean hay that actually was
big? Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. And another short question is, just come back to that question, which was probably said there in the beginning. Was that just a joke you were telling about the man that, you know, that was arrested?
That was a joke, yeah.
Oh, yeah, proving the point about that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry.
Just about how,
oh, yeah, how it came about.
The people at the time were very well-known.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
he's totally innocent, man, that character.
No,
I was just the contemporary.
Yeah, but I wasn't here. I know the story, but I wasn't here because I wasn't here.
Right. Couple of things. I was just wondering when you were doing your bit of research for this at the time. I mean, was there a particular anti-immigrant angle as well too in the trial? That because I mean, of the whole thing, you know, from the start of my understanding of American history and American labor history at the time is that, you know, that socialism and immigrants, you know, and particularly anarchism immigrants were particularly linked in the imagination of the American press and the people who wrote those papers and the thing I would ask is, you know, did the trial and the reportage around it have a particular xenophobic angle, and also as well too, was this used as well too at the time as a wedge to try and create a division, you know, between say the working class that would have been say American born and, you know, that would have had, I suppose, for want of a better word, maybe a sort of a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant background, and then all these you know, sort of, you know, Southern European and Irish American, you know, the Irish and Irish American workers who came from, you know, a Roman Catholic tradition, or, you know, the it played into sort of, you know, sort of nativist versus immigrant, that this is being stored up by the American ruling class.
Yeah.
There's another thing I'm trying to remember as well too about the Haymarket Martyrs as well too, is that they're supposedly, I mean, I could have this wrong or backwards or whatever, but there was, I think the, was it the city of Chicago put up, or was it the police force badgered the city council, and I assume that it didn't take much badgering to put up a memorial to the coppers killed in the Haymarket Haymarket incident, and that it was regularly vandalised all the way through its existence, and I think they even had to put a permanent police guard on it. Such was the strength of feeling in the city for many years afterwards. And I wonder, there's one thing I don't know is, has there ever been a memorial for the actual hitmen hanged in Chicago?
Oh, there's a big memorial there.
Yeah.
There's two memorials. There's the memorial in near Haymarket, and there's also the memorial where they're buried.
Yeah.
But to come back just briefly to the issue of the immigrants, yeah, the whole thing was that socialist anarchist ideas were foreign, alien ideas to the American culture. And I mean, you know, that was early American society. But, I mean, that's been a recurring theme to present socialist anarchist ideas as alien to the American dream, alien to the American experience. And I mean, during the Red Scare following the Bolshevik Revolution, when large numbers of immigrants were actually expelled from the United States, that was the same thing again. The U.S. had the right to get rid of these people and their ideas because they were un-American and they were dangerous to the concepts of freedom that America... I mean, it was complete bullshit, as we know, but, I mean, these were strong ideas, and there has been a recurrent theme of using ethnic division there and fostering racism and ethnic strife.
Yeah.
But to the credit of the movement in Chicago, it was a very broad, ethnically vibrant movement. And I think on the day of the actual protest where the bomb was thrown, the posters were printed in German and in English. German immigrants were a huge section of the immigrant community in Chicago. Of course, a number of those who were later executed of German background, but it was a big feature of it to portray these ideas as un-American, you know, to differing degrees of success.
Yeah, I think James, I'll leave that not with any other homework and go on.
I'm only very brief point, and it's just related to, because the ethnic question is raised, and obviously there are a lot of Irish immigrants in Chicago, particularly large Irish community there and Irish American community. What's interesting is that the Chicago Police Department actually has an extremely big Irish American contingent in it, and there's actually a monument below on my car to a particular police chief, Chief O'Neill, who was the head of Chicago Police and was a notorious strike breaker in his times, both the brothers and his biography, which there's no copies of the here from him, but I can give you a copy of one. what's interesting about the guy is because he collected folklore, Irish folklore, which is very important. That's how he was best known. And about a year ago, I got a little copy of his biography, and I sent him to West Cork. But I started reading it, and that's the last of his diary in it. And the guy was a complete, he was completely right wing and anti worker, and basically had organised the breaking strike. Very important organising the breaking strike there. The key. Individual in it. But what's interesting is that the Irish people obviously is really organized work and that we were fighting lots of people who quite bought the system that the police uniform. They come from Ireland just after the famine in that period and bought completely the system. So there's no, if you want an ethnic, there's no real division. It's all about your ideas, like, and what kind of you bought it, you get bought it, and there it is. But just the lines in West Cork becomes this folklore collection.
You'll have to go and visit us.
Maybe next May then, you know.
Yes.
Is that in the blow, no?
No.
No, Jonathan.
Well, you had a case there where, in Innocent Men, where sentenced to death by the judiciary that weren't interested in justice. They weren't interested in justice. They had predetermined what the verdict would be. And the same thing has happened in Ireland, and it could happen again. And one, the most notorious case was that of Nicky Kelly. But as well as that, a case that I knew because I knew the people involved very well, and I had plenty of time at the time. I had plenty of time to take an interest in the case at the time. And that was Eamon McIntosh. Eamon McIntosh was charged with membership of the IRA on the basis of a magazine that was founded in his office called Irish. So Irish. Now, Irish is an Irish word meaning journal, but also stands for Irish Republican Information Service or something like that. And this was a glossy, very well written magazine that was sent out to foreign embassies and sort of notables, intellectuals, bishops, and so on. And it was claimed in court that it was sort of an internal magazine for IRA members, which it patently wasn't. In fact, the first time I read the Iris was actually when I was assigned in Cohesia prison, so it actually got in past the sentence on Cohesia prison. And Eamon McIntosh, in that case, the judges had made up their mind, three judges made up their mind, this man is going to be nailed. But the most serious case was that Nicky Kelly. It was absolutely an organisation that Nicky Kelly was not a member of, actually admitted responsibility for the Salmon train mail robbery. But nevertheless, every time he appealed the case and it came up before Supreme Court judges, several times they found, you know, that the man was guilty, even though he couldn't, like the Haymarket Marcus, he couldn't have been there at the time. Eventually, Mary Robinson was going to take his case to the European Court of Justice. And when she became president, she got presidential power. But those men, like were judges, it just shows you that the judges in this state are just as biased as the judges that condemned the men in Haymarket.
Who's going to judge the judges?
We will. Up against the wall.
Okay, thanks, John.
Thank you for the context that's there for anyone.